You're listening to What the SaaS, the Future of FinTech, a podcast hosted by Paul Josephak, the CEO and co-founder of Receive. On the show, Paul speaks with industry leaders and experts on the many topics surrounding digitalization, innovation, and the future of FinTech. We'll share ideas and solutions that can help companies and their customers get the best experience possible and help them win back the modern world of finance. So let's jump into the show. Paul, take it away.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm here with Matthias Krinner today. Super happy to have him on our now third podcast. He's probably one of the most, experienced guests for podcasts from the folks we've talked to so far. So he'll definitely know how to introduce himself. I'll just say one thing about Matthias. He's been with us from practically day one on the Receive journey, if we want to call it that. He's one of our business angels. He was one of the first people to say yes. So we're extremely thankful for that. I hope we can pay him back that in thousandfolds or whatever the goal is. But you know what, Matthias, why don't you do this? Why don't you just jump in, give us your standard background, and then we'll dive in and just get to chatting.
Great, Paul. Thank you for having me. That's a great pleasure and absolutely an honor. Second, congratulations to all the success Receive is showing and Receive and the team is showing so far. It is an absolute privilege to be kind of on your side for that journey. I really enjoy it. It's really great. So coming to my background, as you would say, maybe a fintech veteran. So I had the privilege to co-found two banks, the first one in the mid-90s, which was a discount broker actually called Direktanlagebank. And, maybe we speak...
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we speak about the most recent developments that are just taking place with gazillions of valuations. So, I would say DAB, by the way, was something like a first wave discount broker. So that is, since Corona, we are talking in waves. So this is bank number one. Bank number two, I had the privilege to co-found and also like DAB then run is Fidar, which we handed in the application in 2007, ish, 2008, and finally then kicked off in January 2010, which we then sold in 2016 and I left in 2019. So that's a bit of my background. It's customer centric, I would say. It's always tech enabled. There are no technology. None of those concepts would have been even existing. And rule breaking. I would say this, my second first name is rule breaking.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess especially in the early to mid 90s, you guys were definitely super early. I think almost, I don't want to say too early, but 10 years later, you would have been doing your A round at a billion valuation, right?
Well, yeah, too early might be also a second first name. Things happen actually when they happen, as stupid as that might sound. The days I was there at DAB Bank, and it was one of my bosses coming along saying, listen, Matthias, why don't we set up something like Charles Schwab? And, you have to know that my kind of business background from the very early beginning is actually hospitality business. So I was only there for doing an intern and a management trainee. That was it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. I started my business life in hospitality. So after my military service, there you can see that I'm really old. So after my military service, I did an apprenticeship at the Munich Hotel Vier Jahreszeiten, which is Kempinski. Wow. Then I worked in London at the Hyde Park Hotel, which is today a Mandarin Oriental. And I've been, that is the reason why I had the privilege to go to Cornell for hotel and restaurant administration and so on, management stuff, but only for the summer. And did study that then later in Munich, because the Munich University is a partner to Cornell with that program. Mm-hmm. And did some kind of intern in between the reading periods. I did intern. So this is why I was, and now I'm going to kind of tell you a super secret. This is why I was twice assistant Geschäftsführer, so managing director of one of the Oktoberfest tents.
So, oh, cool.
Yeah, so I was once at the Hacker Tent assistant Geschäftsführer, and the second time at the Armbrust Schützenzelt assistant Geschäftsführer. So I'm ready.
Okay. Right. It says a lot now. Now a lot of things are clicking.
My erratic behavior. Yeah. Yeah.
And drinking
and
skills.
Only did join actually the banking environment because at Cornell we had a professor who always said, listen, if you want to run your hotel group successfully, you need to know how the enemy is working. And that enemy is the bank. So I was on bank's territory when suddenly somebody came along and said, why don't we set up something like Charles Schwab? My initial answer was, hey, I only know Ritz-Carlton. So, but you know, 20 minutes later, I knew about Charles Schwab. And, and that was in, I would guess, something like April, May 1993. And in August, we traveled to the U.S. We created the kind of stack and blueprint for this new bank. And in May 16th, as much as I remember, 1994, we lifted the curtain for the Direct Anlagebank. Way too early. Now, if you look at what's happening today with the neo brokers and so on, that's amazing. First of all, when I left DAB Bank in the year 2002, so almost 10 years later, I was so much kind of assured that maybe that was my personal bias and I was just burned out with that topic, that industry does not need any more innovation, at least for the time being. Now we see what's happening. And because you come back to the venture capital and A rounds and so on, there was nothing like that, Paul. You know that. There was nothing like that. There was no VC VC was very limited. Private equity, I wouldn't recall. And in particular, not for seed rounds or something like that. Nothing. So,
but then Schwabtel, I mean, you had like Strashek with Technology Holding.
Yeah.
But that was like 97-ish, right?
Yeah.
And anything before that was just non-existent at all.
And tech-focused, as you said. And tech focused. Yes, of course, we had Strashek over here in Munich then also. And we just had a conversation about that topic yesterday. And we only had that name in mind then.
Well, it was just Strashek and it was Rolf Dienst whatever it was called before Wellington.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And that was it. That was the whole VC community.
Yeah. So, and still then recalling, you know, the days when we founded Feeder, in 2007-08, I think we handed in the application just days upfront to the credit crunch and so on. There was hardly any venture cap around who was willing to invest into a regulated entity. The first ones I met always told me, listen, you want to do the financial revolution? If this is the financial revolution, you have to set up a bank without a license. Then we are investing. And I said, yeah. Well, guys, yeah, exactly. It will be a very short adventure, actually. And I can tell you the outcome upfront so we can save that time and in particular the money. And it took some time. Yeah, actually. Yes, but you're right, Paul. We've been ahead of the curve many, many times conceptually with this setup of corporations. By that, well, we paved the way maybe for others, which you know, is nice, but you always are the second winner, never the first. So, nothing I could buy me something from, you know?
Yeah, I think you and I both could probably exchange war stories for hours. I mean, if I think about it, like same, you know, I'm a couple of years younger than you, I think, not by much, but I was also starting in Germany in 93, right? So, yeah. And I mean, there was nothing here, right? I mean, the whole wave of the first bubble, which was the late 90s, the initial wave, which was, well, let's say like the Amazon, Netscape, Yahoo, what else, eBay wave, that wasn't even registering in Germany in like 94, 95. No one caught it.
Paul, we speak about AOL, you know?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
It is that long, and the younger generation, you need to explain AOL.
I know. And then my joke is always that you know how old someone is if they still have like a web.de or GMX email address, right? Yeah, it's well, just like in the US, if someone has Hotmail, it's like, oh man, you are old.
Here you go.
I mean, again, some of us keep our emails, but I think I had a T-Online email address in the 90s, and I got rid of that one because I switched to Hotmail.
And you with Receive, you are in the data business. So actually for us, I would say the banks, having such an email address is a real asset because it is indicating that the person, it's a KYC relevant asset, you know, and this is why whenever you have a kind of, to all the listeners out there, I would say whenever you have a vintage email address that has a history of 10 to 15 years, this is an asset. Believe me, if you sell it somewhere in the dark web, high price, yeah.
Yeah. And first of all, it's not just the email, it's your phone number too, right? Some of us probably have the same phone number for the last 20 years. I definitely do. My mobile number hasn't changed since 99 or something like that. Insane. I'm actually always contemplating switching it out just to like get rid of people, you know, calling who shouldn't be, but there's history, right?
Yeah. So, I'm not sure if my 1999 provider is still around, but
yeah, that's where Deutsche Telekom actually was a good choice.
That is right. Most certainly.
One benefit. Let me jump to a completely different thing. So I actually have you on a podcast. We're not really a fintech podcast, right? I mean, I'm using this just to be honest, it's more about having fun and talking to people that are kind of close to Receive and kind of my network. But I mean, what's your take on this whole podcasting world and kind of in the fintech space? I know you've been on a bunch of episodes. Yeah. What's your take? I mean, is it a relevant channel? What do you think about what's going on in Germany or in Europe, kind of in this space? Is it going to ever become something?
I think it is definitely a very good add-on for all of us. You know, just most recently when I had a meeting over here in Munich. Now the first face-to-face meeting again for lunch. Totally not used to that anymore. Because,
foreign, right?
Yeah, because you know the meeting started at 12:30 until 14:00. And at 14:00, I had the next call, and I found out, hey, we need logistics in between. This is not working, you know. So, and driving there, I listened to a very interesting podcast. Actually, that was having the person as a guest I was just about to meet, you know.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah. So that was super super interesting. That was the perfect thing to do while driving. And now even that this is, let me say, one of the very special cases. But I think it makes a lot of sense. I use that increasingly if I look at me and myself as an own my behavior, listener behavior, so to say. So I really enjoy that. On the one side. On the other side, you indicated it. I'm a co-host of Breaking Bangs. So Brett King's Breaking. This is Brett King at the Breaking Bang. I think half of the success of a podcast is the voice. I'm a co-host there, not in a very high frequency, but once in a while. I do really enjoy that as being the host also because As you just indicated, that you meet a lot of people you normally would maybe not meet, or if you have kind of you know guests like you know the two of us, we know each other for decades, so to say. it's a very natural conversation then, and I think that gives you a lot that could give a lot also to the listeners. So I would say it has its right to be there. It's going to stay definitely. And I personally enjoy it increasingly.
Okay, and kind of along those lines. I mean, I have some questions I wanted to ask, and I was just kind of thinking that you're probably the perfect person for this. I mean, do you see? I mean, one of the things we're doing with Receive is that we're very just content driven, right? I mean, we want to put stuff out there that's relevant to our customers, but also kind of just relevant in general, right? Because if it's boring, who cares, right? Do you think that the kind of the fintech world can actually become better at really communicating what these products are capable of doing? Yeah,
absolutely. It's as always. It's not a fintech phenomenon only. It is.
I know it's much better in other industries, right?
Yeah, but it's a B2B/engineering topic. You know, this is like given the fact, as I indicated in the beginning, is that all our business is tech related. If technology wouldn't be around, none of our businesses would be existing, and we would be maybe, I would be still maybe sitting on the Oktoberfest counting the beers. I wouldn't. So it's all tech related. This means we are all our corporate culture is very tech heavy. Mm. And with tech heavy corporate culture, and really it is not good nor bad. It is just what it is. You have this kind of engineering culture and so on and so forth. Mm. Engineers by definition are not good in selling. First of all, engineers by definition, are, let me say, sometimes lacking a little bit of an empathy for the customer. Yeah, because there are so much, or maybe, not generalizing, but maybe they are so much in love with their technical solution. And in particular, look at the German car industry. They just forget about what is reasonable and what makes sense and how to sell that. You know, there's a golden rule, actually, when you speak about selling, it is that Paul is collapsing.
Drop my pen.
Yeah, there's a golden rule when you speak about selling. It is that, for instance, you only would speak out of the time you have with your customer, you only speak 5 to 10% about your business case and 90 to 95% about something else, to give a good feeling, to maybe show a little bit of your background and
building rapport.
Then exactly. So an engineer never would or maybe never could do this, yes, long answer, but the essence is very short. Yes, we definitely could do better. I think a very successful, successful B2B tech offers are telling the customer already what you can do with it. Mm. It is always hard to sell if the customer has to find out him or herself what I could do with it. This is like selling a toolbox with a screwdriver. You do not sell by telling everybody this screwdriver is made out of metal with a plastic grab and so on and whatsoever. No, you sell the dream, what you can create out of it. And this is what you have to transport.
My favorite sales term in that sense is you'll always sell the sizzle and never the steak. And if you've ever been to a steakhouse in the US, when they bring you out, it's always sell that sizzle. That's what you're trying to get.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask a different question or the same thing, but from a different perspective, because this is one of the things I keep asking myself, talking to the customers, right? And we're selling primarily to banks, but we're going also after public utilities and kind of, let's call them state industries, right? They're not necessarily highly kind of, I don't want to say not innovative. I mean, a lot of them are becoming extremely innovative, but a lot of the people you end up talking to aren't necessarily first movers. Let's call it that. But what I'm actually asking myself, especially for fintechs, and I mean, even some of the ones that are a little bit more, kind of mainstream, I'm wondering whether the actual customer, so let's say like an N26, they might show up somewhere on a consumer's radar, and obviously their customers are consumers. But if you're looking at the B2B space, and which, a lot of fintechs actually are much more B2B, right? Or they're trying to quasi sell their product to someone who isn't the typical consumer. And I'm always asking myself whether there is or there needs to be more on both sides, right? So on the one hand, that more content is generated to actually educate the market. But conversely, I'm also asking myself, why aren't a lot of these executives actually much more nose to the ground? Because it feels like they're completely aloof, right? I mean, I end up talking to some customers where, I'll just make an anecdote from a recent customer interaction where we brought up something about Netflix. Mm-hmm. And a person on the other side asked us what Netflix was.
Oh, really?
I mean, and I don't mean that in a derogative way. It's someone who feels that they don't need to be on the pulse of what's happening in technology, mm-hmm. even though they're an executive in a larger corporation. I mean, what's your thoughts there? I mean, are the executives in these banks and public utilities and whatnot just not keeping up?
Yeah, that's the short answer. Yes, yeah. And the reasons for that are multiple. Speaking about banks and speaking about incumbents.
Well, I'm asking about the banks because you have the inside experience. Yeah. Right? But you were definitely much one of the people who was doing everything possible to be up to speed.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, but I still, after being almost now 28 years in the financial services industry, I do not regard myself to be a banker, first of all. Mm. And still, second, I'm extremely curious. I'm even, you know, once I left Federer, that was on the 31st of March 2019, you know, on April 1st, the phone started ringing and I've been kind of dragged away and entering new uncharted territory for me and so on and so forth. You know, I literally had not 5 minutes of kind of leaning back and say, yeah, well, let me go on an island and do the 1 year philosophy of my raison d'être and so on and so forth. No, it was kind of because I really had the feeling to lose grab. I was really very much afraid of losing the grab, the contact, and everything else to the fast moving developments of that industry. And I would say that already makes me super different to the maturity of incumbent bankers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But first of all, they do not know that there is something happening. They just know it by the newsletters they are maybe receiving. Mm-hmm. Then they do not know the root causes for this. Then you do not understand the dynamics of it. You do not have this kind of experience, Paul, like you and me, we are having as entrepreneurs. This is a totally different experience.
Oh, yeah.
And if you are a manager only, so to say, you know, mm-hmm. it's totally different. Once you could lose maybe everything you put in for the investment into this company, which might be your pension and your kids' education, and you're fucking scared to death. Sorry for that. We can,
but no, we can curse all we want.
Yeah, but you're scared to death that the investment might be gone versus a manager of an incumbent who might lose 10% of the variable component of the payment of the last year. You know, So the heat is on the one side, while on the other side, it is security centric. So this is a kind of culture thing. And you're not rewarded for taking risk. This is the problem. You know, it's a risk culture. It's a risk averse culture, while startups are risk centric. Mm-hmm. You're not rewarded for that. You might be, you know, I've had my experience in this now already. As I told you, we sold Feeder to an incumbent. You know, we've been bought for innovation, and after a while, somebody found out that innovation might come with a risk. Oh, really? That is surprising, is it? Yeah. So it's a totally different setup. It's also that, in particular, in banks, actually, when you have this risk cultures and risk, which is described by a risk strategy, which needs to be audited as part of your corporate setup there, all like compliance and everything else, you know, you're not fitting into that grid. This is the problem, you know, and you cannot even accuse those people because somebody, and this is a typical thing in a big corporation, somebody did it. Nobody knows why and who was it and when, but somebody said, this is not allowed. Okay, we can't do this. Okay, this is it. Forget about it. This is why,
well, I guess,
why I'm so skeptical regarding the question buy, build, or cooperate. Whenever it comes to an acquisition of a fintech by an incumbent, this is causing my skepticism because the fintech would need to do a buyer's due diligence on the existing risk strategy.
Yeah.
And whether this is even allowed, because maybe it's not even allowed to buy me. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Or you even worse, you might actually get completely screwed because when you do your due diligence, a year later, management changes and it doesn't matter anyway, right? I always make the joke that, you know, you and I probably are similar in that sense. I mean, we're both pretty much unemployable, right? I mean, we're both the type of personality that really has no choice. But to you know, kind of as an anecdote, I mean, my time at Otto, and I mean, again, I look back fondly on it and even say, you know, the behavior, all the politics and everything that we all know about, it's not a secret about any large corporation. I can't spite anyone on the other side because you know exactly why they play that game. And some of them play that game brilliantly. Mm. I just don't play that game because I don't really give a shit about the politics. Mm. I don't really give a shit about, you know, playing the role. And at the same time, if you think about when you got bought, there was probably something completely different as an expectation for the acquisition of Feedor. And then a year or two later, it became basically a completely different mindset, right? Because at that point, it's cover your ass. Same thing with me, you know, I was brought in to drive innovation. We drove innovation, but at some point it becomes uncomfortable, right? I mean, the more you push stuff, it's always uncomfortable. As you said, as an entrepreneur, we're used to it. You're basically wondering whether you're going to be broke, you know, at the end of the month, or let's say something else, whether your company is going to be broke and you're even going to make payroll. But yeah, I couldn't agree more, but I still ask myself whether we're going to be getting somewhere soon, because you've always been driving the technology first agenda. I completely believe in the technology first agenda, but if these large corporations are not really willing to make those or to take those risks, is building startups to be sold to corporates actually completely the wrong idea? I mean, ultimately you have to build up a business that's standalone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what we see currently, and we, in the beginning, I mentioned that this gazillion valuations of fintechs, like Trade Republic, what we learned.
Yeah, that was nuts. I caught that yesterday.
Yeah. So
hats off though, by the way, I'm always happy about anyone who can pull shit like that off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
congratulations to them.
One guy who is involved in there is Ingo Hillen. I know, He started Sino, which is a great business. I know him since DAB Bank days, and haven't met him too often. But actually, you know, I'm like you, Paul. I really think fantastic job, great. It's creating a very positive sentiment to the whole industry. Of course, not saying that all and everything what in our industry is to be experienced is great and is fantastic and should be valued like this. Of course, this is not what I'm saying, but what we are seeing there is actually that investors are more and more kind of allowing those fintechs to clean up the market, because what we see here is really this is a kind of fuck you money, so to say, that this company will be funded until it is the biggest. This is what it's saying, right?
Yeah. So
what we see is that they are now distributing market share of the future markets. This is what we see today.
And they're funding the future market. They're not funding today. They're funding in 5 years, right?
Exactly. So this is the bet. And by putting that much money on the bet, actually, it's more or less a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, this is so much, by the way, different to Paul. And we spoke a lot. We can't quote that on the podcast now, but we spoke a lot, many, many times about investor behavior and professionalism of venture cap investors and so on. But this, instead of spoon feeding the venture and killing it by that, it's a very professional approach to really say, let me give you that. How much money do you need to empty the market within the next 3 years? And this is what's happening here. So, and this is also then giving you the answer to your question, saying, okay, should we look at the incumbents? No, we shouldn't.
No.
This is over. This time is over. And I only can understand it because, you know, how much homework would you have to transform such an incumbent? Just imagine Commerzbank or whatever, to transform an incumbent into a digital entity. It's a waste of time. Let's face it, you know.
Yep.
I another anecdote, I once was still presenting for Fedora, so it must have been somewhat up earlier than March 2019. I guess it was in 2018 or something. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the Commerzbank C-level guys making a presentation about the success of Commerzbank's digital account.
Mm-hmm.
And then now comes the tagline. And he was standing there. So first of all, he said, no, why should we buy fintech? We just go there and copy it. That is what he announced publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And then imagine, this was based in Frankfurt, 80-90% of the audience thought that this is, well, this is cool, you know? While there was some fintech guys and me sitting in the room, I was totally outrageous. To be honest, I was absolutely outrageous, yeah? What kind of a rotten culture is this person representing? So I was really outrageous, first of all. Second, and then he said, yeah, our digital account, he never explained what digital means to him, but we then got the example. Our digital account is so successful, we needed to walk up to the next Baumarkt or whatever, and we needed to buy baskets to carry away the account applications.
Mm.
Find the mistake. You know, what? I was sitting there saying, this is it? This is you're really telling me this? And he was so proud of that. You know, you could see this, you know. And yeah, but this is describing, why am I telling this anecdote? This is pass pro toto. This is describing the environment.
Right? But it's also, I have, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I have to say another just anecdote from my perspective. One of the things that I'm seeing here, I mean, it's a European thing, but it's related. I mean, I already mentioned N26, and it's not N26 specific, but someone I know who was looking for an apartment recently happens to have an N26 bank account. And you have to imagine that the landlord is like, oh, well, I can't take you seriously because you use N26 as your bank account. Where I was like, are you kidding me?
Oh, wow.
Like, what a mindset, right? I mean, it was obviously someone older and who is obviously not used to kind of the new types of banks that are out there, and they expect Commerzbank or Deutsche Bank or whatever, you know, whatever the typical bank. Sparkasse, Haspa, yeah. But not to say anything bad about Haspa, but again, I think it's just, it's on both ends of the equation. Yeah. Before we run out of time, I have like 30 questions that I definitely would not get to asking you because you and I are the worst to have on a podcast.
It is.
Embedded finance. That's kind of a topic that we're always kind of touching upon. And I'm sure you are as well. What's your thoughts? I mean, what's embedded finance going to become? Where's that going?
Well, if I read embedded finance correctly, it's really this kind of then reaching out into bank as a service, open banking in this setup and environment. And I would say that's the way it's going to be. Even at Feeder Days, actually, we always said that the future kind of primary banking relation will be non-visible to the customer anymore, to the bank customer anymore, because it is, you know, we're going to speak about Internet of Things. We have this open banking and so on and so forth. We have an increasing digitalization. Now COVID did drive this massively. And if you're going to see, there's one role model for me, which is Klarna, you know? Yep. And I have to say Klarna, for instance, with all respect, they do a fantastic job. Now, if you have, you come to the checkout cartridge at an e-commerce, you find Klarna. You find Sofort Überweisen, which they acquired years ago, and so on and so forth. So this is, for me, a role model of embedded finance. But the flip side of the coin for the industry, there's only one, right? It's not that at this point of the cartridge you would have something like, you have 15 banks to select, how do you want to pay? This is not what happens. You have Klarna there, right?
Exactly.
And this is why this is again showing you, and I honestly have to say, when we started Feeder, I did not get too much into this, but this is showing you how you need to understand e-commerce, for instance, e-commerce, or let's take gaming, how you need to understand those specific digital environments and industries to really create a financial service that is embedded then, and what we embedded is seamless, knitted into the process. And how little has been delivered, and how little, and only by very selective partners, has been delivered. You know, if banks would have been so innovative, PayPal wouldn't be around. Yep. If banks would have been so innovative, Klarna wouldn't be around. Obviously, Klarna detected a continent of new financial services opportunities, which was untapped or unforeseen by the banks. And then we come back to the point: why are banks incumbents where they are?
So if you think about it, there's one kind of hidden secret there. And I mean, I'm putting my old VC hat on. If you kind of look at what happened in the US, that's the things that in Europe, a Klarna, Adyen, a couple other players in Europe did brilliantly in terms of copying the strategy of go to market. They actually were able to focus on a lot of the startups and grew with the startups or the startup community. So initially, Klarna went into kind of the challengers and then ultimately went into the large enterprises and basically became the market leader or almost the market leader on the back of a growing wave of basically startups. I mean, Adyen did the same thing, right? I mean, they were super active in Berlin. They were basically going into everything that the Zumbers did or whatever, right? I mean, it was always on the back of everything. And they got big with some of these other companies getting big as well. I think that's what ultimately is going to be the case for anyone who's positioning themselves with, be it embedded finance or anything as a fintech. If you can get in with the next wave of let's say industry evolution, and start with the smaller players and then grow as they grow, you just can completely sidestep all the incumbents, right?
And now we come back to the risk policy of a bank, you know, because unless you have, if you are a bank which is declaring SME business to be evil, forget about it. And I know banks, believe me, out of the very, very close look at it, Feeder was very close to the SME business until we had to learn that SMEs are evil by the risk policy by somebody, right?
Yeah,
so,
of course.
Yeah, okay. So happy days of banking are over then. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Well, look at the next wave. The next wave they're missing is cryptocurrency, right? I mean, you can be for or against it, but obviously the incumbents are not engaging or not enough.
Yeah, right? The same thing. You know, we had discussions in which the risk cryptocurrencies then finally had been declared to be a reputational risk. Mm-hmm. And reputational risk as an argument you only use once you have no other arguments, because this is the, so to say, the miscellaneous. You
know, it's a kill all.
Yeah, right? Exactly. We cannot tell really why we don't like it. So that's a reputational risk. So, and there are so many unknowns that are, even yesterday on German television, the lady said that the pipeline operators in the U.S. had been paid the fraudsters in bitcoins because they could track and trace the payment. I said, listen, lady, you are willingly distributing so much BS about it. It's so untrue what you're saying. So that's the one side. The other side is really that I would say that in particular the crypto environment, of course, there's a lot of BS going on. I would say the majority of currencies are not needed at all. But there are some very, very brilliant concepts out there, first of all. Second, it makes a lot of sense to have an alternative currency. We can speak about that for hours.
Yeah, next podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Third of it, if we only look at it out of a European perspective or of a developed market perspective, we might not really meet the point, because I would say that crypto, in particular Bitcoin, is very, very much needed for broken states and broken currencies. Mm. It's the only safe harbor for those people, for instance, in Venezuela, or let's take Turkey or other nations in which the currencies lost a lot of purchasing power by the behavior of the government. Yeah. I'm not judging that. I'm just looking at
it. It is what it is.
It is what it is, sadly, for the people living there. So if you look at this, actually, African states and so on, you can see the real reason for those currencies as a storage. Of course, it's used for speculation. Hey, it's not the first currency used for speculation, isn't it?
Yeah,
surprise, surprise. You know, and it's not the first currency used for money laundry, and it's not the first currency used for frauds by fraudsters. You know, because that all would imply that kind of fraudulent behavior only started when Bitcoin was around.
Yeah.
You know, the history of crime is telling me something different. But anyhow, besides all that, you know, I think it needs to professionalize that market instead of ban it. Why? Because if it's professionalized, there would be way more money around in the market. We would kill volatility. You know, we would kill the status that one person by saying, yeah, I accept Bitcoin, or no, I don't accept Bitcoin, causing 20-30% of volatility. And this is showing me that this is an immature market. Yeah. Actually, if there would be more money in the market, if there would be more professionalism by products and so on, and accessibility in the market, this kind of volatility wouldn't happen. Because the US dollar is not causing volatility. If Elon Musk is saying, yeah, you can buy a Tesla with US dollars, the US dollar is not going up 20%. Yeah.
But if you think about it, I mean, it showed a kind of resilience, because it did have that dip kind of a day later, but it's now creeping back up again. And it didn't drop by, you know, 75-85%. It was, I don't know, 20-30%, and it's already probably recovered 10%. Yeah. I don't know where it is today. I didn't look. But again, I think we're not going to avoid it in the future. I'm actually an optimist around it. If for no other reason than I see a path forward around, you know, kind of what they're selling.
So. If you we at Federer started the business by, first of all, when Oliver Flaskemper from Bitcoin.de came up to Federer and said, listen, would you like to cooperate with us, and would you like to enable our business? And we said, yeah, wow, that looks absolutely fantastic and cool. Let us sort out with the regulator how to embrace that. And we had a very deep chat with the Munich Bundesbank, and we defined demarcation lines, what Federer Bank might do, what Federer Bank might never do. And there was one very important argument to the regulator saying, listen, you have two choices. Actually, the one is you ban it, it still will happen. You ban it and you declare it to be a gray or black market in any meaning. You know, the money will be lost, right? Or the other way is you kind of mentally open yourself, you allow us to embrace and support that company, and you will have firsthand information, because you have to ask us whenever you audit us as a bank. We have to give you the information, what transactions are and so on and so forth. So you get it firsthand instead of reading it out of the newspaper, because the journalists might have not got the point of the story, oftenly, by the way. So luckily, Munich Bundesbank those days then said, yeah, okay, go ahead and let's have a close look and let's see what's happening. And I think this is a basic principle you have to follow up. I believe strongly in open systems, strongly, and open and transparency to a certain degree, of course, in those systems, because then you create the trust. By the trust, you create the liquidity in the market, and those places need liquidity. They even need, obviously, more liquidity than there is in it today.
Switching to kind of a mutually beneficial question. So when it comes to your background, and you were one of the few people who really got what we were going after early days with kind of the collection story around Receive. Has your thinking there changed or evolved over the last 2 years or so that we've been kind of doing this together? I mean, what's your thoughts on the future of digital collections and kind of with your experience in the banking world, just or your investment thesis even for being involved?
It didn't change at all. The opposite is the case. Remember, Paul, you started the journey, and I'm very happy you invited me to that journey before even something like COVID was around. Remember?
A year before that.
Exactly. Yeah. And remember when we spoke about the impact of COVID for the first time?
Yep.
We both very, very quickly have been on the side to say, okay, there will be a certain impact of COVID to the sustainability of balance sheets at the bank side. Well, we did not know that governments actually will spend trillions into the market. However, it is estimated that we have approximately 5,000 corporations in Germany only that could be called zombie companies. Mm-hmm. We definitely will see a strong shift in the market behavior, more to the digital one. So on and so forth. So I think that the case of Receive is more valid than ever. Absolutely. More valid than ever. Not only in a European environment, in particular also in an we spoke about that many times, in an Asian environment, Southeast Asia environment. Yeah. The principle thesis didn't change at all. First of all. Second, I did not in the meantime see any incumbent now really moving into AI-based collections and so on and so forth, so kind of creating it themselves. Forget about it. They are so much covered with dealing with their kind of backlog of their legacy. They have 110% maintenance kind of cost to the stack and so on. It's not simple. It's not working. They cannot embrace innovation. They cannot come over it. So they need guys like Receive to take care of that. So and we will see that. Sadly, COVID-19 and its support payments, we will see that at the end of the day, that the spread of poor people and very, very ultra rich people will be enlarging. Mm. Yeah. So we will see more and more people being distressed. So sadly, on this side, I have to say that it needs support for the bank and any other comparable, for the bank, retailers, and so on, and the customer to come to a proper cash and spending behavior and cash management, which at the end of the day is the impact Receive can deliver.
That's what we're after.
Yeah.
On that note, so I'm trying to keep this in your agenda. I have one question I ask everyone at the end. You already kind of said the anti-answer. So you said if you were doing something else, it definitely wouldn't be working at a beer tent. But if you weren't in the kind of startup world, what would you be doing otherwise? I mean, would you be running a hotel? I mean, is that what your alternative path was? Or
believe me, definitely. Yeah. Believe me, my wife and I, once in a while, we often think about what would it be like having a small kind of very nice boutique-ish 5 to 10 rooms, more or less family style hotel in a gorgeous location. I could imagine that straight away, you know.
I know, but a couple people who did it. You can fall on your face with that one. It's really boring fast.
That's what I just wanted to say. But one day, again, I will be sitting in the cellar and starting it.
I was about to say, are you? What are you working on now? I mean, as to finish on that note, what's keeping you busy now?
No, thank you for that question. That allows me to maybe speak a little bit about a company which is called TradeLight Solutions. And TradeLight is actually very, very exciting. And it's about the first time I speak in public about that.
Oh, great.
We kept it in a very hidden stealth modus for quite a long time now. And it's a managed service operating at the intersection of financial market data and video games. Ba-ba, that's it.
And that's where you're going to leave it at. On that note, we'll cut here. Matias, it was great having you. I'd love to definitely get you back at some point because I think we could probably do an hour or two easy. We'll definitely see each other hopefully in the interim. So I'm starting to travel as well. I'm having my first business dinner tonight as well in person. So
wow.
It feels like this like kind of lightness of being is finally back in. And I'm traveling to Spain in a week to go see customers in Spain. So I'm slowly ramping back up. So hopefully we can cross paths somewhere.
We will, as always. We did for decades.
We tried to avoid each other for 10 years and we just kept seeing each other, right?
Exactly.
All right, Matias, thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Fantastic. Yeah, and as you said, we could go on hours like that.
We'll do it next time. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so
Take
much.
Care.
Bye.